Now we go overseas. You are listening to a podcast from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, Germany, in cooperation with volunteers in the United States. Part 3, Zwieback and Captain's Dinner. How a 5-year-old and a 17-year-old, each from Hesse, experienced their first sea voyage and what became of them and others. Disappeared the beach, disappeared the land, ship on the high seas. All around us are waves, and sea is all I see. Swaying the waves, seagulls flying homewards. Golden shines the sun, hearts full of bliss. Homeland, goodbye.
Let's accompany two young people from Hesse on their first sea voyage. We will meet Edmund, a Melsinger, who worked his way up from ship's boy to captain and later escaped the largest civilian nautical disaster in German waters. First, we will meet Ruth, a seaworthy 5-year-old from Niederohmen, who experienced her family's escape from Nazi Germany as an adventure.
Hamburg, Hamburg, this is the final stop of this train. Everybody off, the conductor shouted, along with hundreds of other passengers in their muted winter coats, hats, and scarves. My father in his bulky brown overcoat and my mother in her dark blue one disembarked into the train station. Papa was carrying 2 large suitcases and Mama 2 small ones. Papa sat his down on the platform, turned to the train, and lifted me off the top step. I, too, was wearing a warm coat to ward off the January chill. Mine was maroon and flared out at the waist. Mama had bought it in Gießen, and I thought it was ever so pretty. I was sleepy and disoriented. My mother had packed lots of food for the 9-hour trip from Niederohmen to Hamburg, the seaport where we were to board the ship that would sail to America. Some dark bread, yellow cheese, and a shiny red apple helped me to regain some of my 5-year-old interest in everything that was happening around me.
So they sold their belongings, said goodbye to friends and relatives, and then left their small village in the Vogelsberg with a heavy heart. Like many Jewish men after the pogrom night of 1938, Joseph Stern had been in a concentration camp. With a little that he, his wife Hannah, and his daughter Ruth are allowed to take with them, they reach Hamburg. As Jewish immigrants, they have to endure final checks, harassment, and humiliation before they can leave Germany and are finally out of danger.
Along with other suitcase-laden passengers, we were herded onto buses that bound for the ship's dock. All of us were Germans who were fleeing because of Hitler's persecutions. There were people who openly disagreed with the regime. Professors, writers, homosexuals, and, of course, Jews. The bus stopped at an enormous square building that must have been a warehouse once. The warehouse had been turned into a center for examining the luggage and bodies of the departing refugees to make sure that they didn't take anything valuable out of the country. I remember the experience as being humiliating. I can only imagine how it was for my parents. My mother and I were directed to an area for women. There, the uniformed officials were women. After we went through the gauntlet and had put on our clothes again, we were told to exit by the door in front of us. I looked straight ahead and saw a huge ship. It looked like it was big enough to hold all the people from Niederolmen and from Gießen, too. Papa told me that it was called the SS Deutschland. I could hardly wait to get on this floating city.
Edmund Valentin Badenhausen, one of the 8 children of Philip and Eleanor Badenhausen, née Schirica, is 17 years old and far from being of legal age when he leaves Melsingen in 1857, and he goes alone. The young man from North Hesse joins the Hapag, also called the Hamburg American Line. He writes letters in diary form and sends them to his parents, asking them to carefully preserve the letters so that they can be published later. His granddaughter, Ida Hasse, has translated the one remaining letter. On October 11, 1857, the 17-year-old wrote,
"On October 2nd, the anxiously awaited packet ship Oda arrived here after a very fast trip from New York, taking only 27 days. I immediately introduced myself to the inspector of American Packet Ship Association, and there I met, by good fortune and chance, my present captain. This man appealed to me immediately, for he was very kind. In fact, his manner showed a strong character. I was told to come back, which I did, and there again found my captain, just as though he had been waiting for me. The inspector wrote down on a slip of paper the equipment which I needed. The captain took the paper and went with me, the future ship's boy, think of my surprise, the top man and the most menial of all, to the storekeeper, who filled my needs and asked when I wanted to come on board. When I told him I wanted to come on board right away, he was satisfied."
Edmund returns to family Bessen, who has taken care of him in Hamburg so kindly that he can hardly find words to express it. The other day, his cousin Wilhelm accompanied him to the ship, but the pilot just looks Edmund all over with a sarcastic smile. He hasn't learned yet how to work, he tells him, and that he would accept him as a ship's boy only if he had a certificate from the inspector. As soon as Edmund has the certificate, he is then accepted. He goes on board and stands there like an abandoned one. The pilot, the sailors, and the ship's boys ignore the new one completely. No one shows him where his place on board will be, or where he should change his clothes in order to go to work, or where he should sleep.
When I asked, no one listened, and the sailors made fun of me. A hundredweight was on my heart, and I almost cried out loud. Then, finally, a sympathetic soul took pity on me, namely the cook's helper, who aided me to take my things into the cabin where the sailors have their place, where they eat, sleep, and do everything. There I quickly dressed and asked the head pilot what I should do. He sent me to polish. I had to polish the compass, all the tin work which reinforced the ship, and the two bells. That lasted until 4 o'clock. Then I helped with the loading. Then I helped get the cargo out of the way. That lasted until 5:30 p.m. Then it was time to eat. The food was potatoes stewed with onions, tea, or milk and sugar, pumpernickel, and the ship's rusks, zwieback. Rye bread tastes like matzah and must lie in the tea a long time until it gets soft. Also, butter. That is, butter that stinks, which the others spread on their bread thickly, but I just scratched it on the bread.
Ruth Shin Stern also enters a new world. The crew treats all passengers equally, and there is no sign of the anti-Semitism they experienced in Germany. And for a small, inquisitive girl, there is so much to discover.
Picture this scenario. You are a 5-year-old child born and raised in a tiny provincial German town in the 1930s, and you find yourself on an ocean liner, the world's largest playground. Think about it. An ocean liner has finite boundaries, so you can't really get lost. The dangerous areas on the ship have locked doors or big red "Do not enter" signs to keep out passengers. So much to look at and learn about. The wide, richly carpeted staircases that led from one deck to another, and then to the staterooms, the game rooms, where adults played chess, cards, and other games. The inviting children's playroom with its wind-up toys, games, large pillows, dolls, and animals of all sizes and shapes. The salons with large windows overlooking the top deck where the grown-ups had cocktails, snacks, and talked to each other. Best of all was the beautiful dining room with its lovely crystal chandeliers. The tablecloths on the round tables were white linen damask. The water goblets at each place setting had a pastel color napkin arranged in it. In the center of each table was a small cut glass bowl of fresh flowers. What an amazing variety of places for a child to explore.
There had never been so much luxury in Upper Hesse.
On the ship's deck, I noticed smiling young men in dark blue uniforms and crisp white shirts scattered about. Each of them had a long sheet of paper in his hand. One of them strode up to us and said, "Welcome aboard the Deutschland. I'm Eric. Tell me your name and I'll show you to your cabin." He took Mama's 2 suitcases with a swift, friendly gesture and led us toward the middle of the ship. And then Eric said, "Here we are, cabin 396, your quarters for the next week. I will be your steward. If you need anything, let me know, and I will do my best to get it." He opened the door to the stateroom, a compact room where everything was neat and orderly. There were two regular-sized beds and a small one for me under the round window that Eric called a porthole. Even a closet, two night tables, and a small bath. I was fascinated when I noticed that everything was attached to the wall or to the floor. I soon found out why.
Back to Hamburg, 1857. When the work on board is done, the sailors go ashore to spend their wages after the long crossing. The new cabin boy stays behind. Where should he sleep? Someone shows him a berth, which he has to share with another boy. The other one is sick. His bloody, sweaty mattress has been thrown overboard. Since then, he has been sleeping on naked boards.
He looks awfully dirty and ugly. He seldomly washes himself. And this is now my sleeping companion. Now I have fixed up my bed. A hard mattress of seaweed and a light horse blanket. That's my bed. At 8 o'clock, all lights must be out on all ships in the Hamburg harbor. Then everyone squeezes and crowds himself into bed. I fell asleep, and even in my sleep, I still heard the lapping of the waves against the bow of the boat, for the sailors' quarters are in the front of the ship.
For Edmund Badenhausen, the first night on board begins. It ends at 6 o'clock in the morning. He writes to his parents and everyone else who will read it.
The next morning, I awoke feeling as though I had taken a beating. That can be easily imagined, for one goes to bed dressed, namely with a blue woolen undershirt, a blue and white striped undershirt, white woolen underpants, and woolen stockings which reach above the knee. During the day, there is added to that heavy sailor's shoes and a sailor's knife on a plaid belt drawn about the body. To that, also a Scots cap, very much like the bishop's hat, and pants of gray leather. That is my costume.
In 1857, the ship's boy learns that it is not customary to say good morning on board, either with the pilot or the captain. He washes himself in a bucket of water and gets his first breakfast.
We drank coffee without milk or anything. After, there was bacon, pumpernickel, and Zwieback. Then the work began. I cleaned and polished in the morning. Breakfast was served at 8 o'clock, the same as we ate at 6 o'clock. In spite of the work, I was extremely bored and terribly homesick. The happy days gone by passed in my mind. I thought of you, dear parents, the unforgettable hours of parting, the solicitous advice, receiving Father's blessing, the loving lingering and nodding up to the window as I went over the market square. I could barely keep back my tears. All watch me while I work, and even now, while I write this, my tears are plentiful thinking of my dear parents, relatives, and friends. Away from home, one realizes rightly why parents, brothers, sisters, and home are so dear and beloved. What a treasure one is left behind when one is among total strangers who don't have a single word of sympathy. They even ridicule the tears of one who thinks of his dear loved ones and order one to work with mockery and curses. This is especially true for the sailors. They cause each other grief, and a seaman must beware of them. He must have a strong character.
We hove. Yes, we hove, yes, we hove, over the great blue sea. Yes, we hove, and have just been in the shallow water here. Great blue plains, expand wide before our eyes. Great blue plains, between us and paradise. Yes, we hover, yes, we hover. Horses drag us overseas. Horses that do live in heaven. They're called wind and don't eat hay. Yes, we hover, yes, we hover, our ways invisible. But we hover, yes, we hover, on this big ship overseas. We are dreaming of a land on the horizon where we'll all be foreigners first. Home of tribes that aren't our own. Yes, we hover, yes, we hover, like gods over the dike. In a land that's rich in dreams, we long for a better life.
The Deutschland, on which the Stern family travels to New York in 1939, gets into heavy seas.
The ship had just started its voyage to Southampton, England. The wind had picked up, the waves were high, and the ship was rolling. After I had been on the top deck, when I opened the door of the cabin, I noticed my mother was lying on the bed and her face was pale. Papa greeted me and explained, "Your mama seems to be a little seasick. She'll probably feel better after she eats." That was not to be. Mama didn't get better. She got worse and worse. I, on the other hand, was well and happy. The North Atlantic storms left me completely unaffected. The wind howled and icy hail pummeled the deck and made noise as it hit the porthole. I enjoyed it all. The decks rolled when you walked on them. Just another challenge for a five-year-old. By midweek, Papa was affected too. Eric came to the rescue. He told the captain about my plight, and that very evening, I ate at the captain's table. What fun it was! The young officers and other guests questioned me and even listened to my responses. I told them about my Uncle Meyer and my Aunt Hedwig and my two cousins. I told them how much I loved Rosie the cow. I told them how the government had taken away my developmentally slow aunt and put her in a hospital, and how I hoped she had made friends there. I felt ever so important and grown up. In fact, the most important I ever felt in my first 5 years of life. And I'll tell you something that Mama never found out. The captain and his friends would let me eat two or even three desserts if I wanted them. Mama never let me do that. I kind of felt sorry for my parents, but I had such a good time eating at the captain's table and being able to go where I wanted that I secretly wished them to stay sick.
Many people struggle with seasickness on their first voyage, but even experienced sailors can be affected by it. The problem is, the eyes transmit to the brain that the body is at rest, and through the vestibular organ in the inner ear, muscles and joints perceive movement. Who is right? There is dizziness and nausea, blurred vision and headaches, sweating and other symptoms, up to circulatory collapse, and death wish. Seasick people vomit because their body interprets this as poisoning based on the symptoms and wants to get rid of the stomach contents as quickly as possible. In the 21st century, medical professionals recommend
antihistamines, which should be taken at least 4 hours before taking off, and parasympatholytics, but also vitamin C, ginger, acupressure tapes, fresh air, warm clothing. It is important to look to the horizon, stay in the middle of the ship, drink enough water, sleep, and eat light meals. For example, fruits and vegetables, raw carrots, soups, zwieback, chamomile, peppermint, and ginger tea. On the list of foods that seasick people should better avoid are histamine-containing foods such as salami, hard cheese, sauerkraut, tomatoes, strawberries, spinach, chocolate, walnuts, bananas, coffee, black tea, green tea, and alcohol.
Up to 90% of people are said to be susceptible to seasickness, including people who have been at sea for a long time. Only children under the age of 2 never get seasick, says the volunteer sea rescue doctor Jens Kofel from the German Society for the Rescue of Shipwrecked Persons in Cuxhaven, who is quoted on their website. In his 1897 Guide to Canada, Heinrich Lemke assumed that 15 to 65-year-olds were particularly affected, rarely children or the elderly, women more often than men.
If ever suffering has been the object of human complaints, it is above all seasickness. It is a disease in which, as they say, one cannot live or die. And it occurs in the passengers when the ship is subjected to greater fluctuations by the movement of the sea. For some, seasickness stops after a few days, after the person gets used to the fluctuations of the ship. Others do not leave it during the whole journey, and it only disappears again when entering the solid land.
From American studies, Lemke knows what can be done about it. 3 days before the departure of their ship, travelers are supposed to take a brominated medicine after consulting a doctor. Did the author also hear that bromine was originally extracted from seaweed? He recommends a mixture of bromides to be taken, a teaspoonful before eating and before going to bed, for 3 days before going on board. However, Ruth Stern's parents apparently did not know the remedy, nor any other. But at some point, the time of nausea comes to an end for them too.
The night before our arrival in New York, the seas turned calm, and we awoke to much excitement. You could hear the passengers' footsteps in the hallways as they hurried to the top deck. No one wanted to miss seeing the Statue of Liberty. The three of us joined the climbing throng of bodies. "Look! It's over there," Papa shouted as he lifted me high. All I could see was a dark, tall object far away in the water. As we watched, the Statue of Liberty became the majestic figure of a woman in flowing robes, holding aloft a flaming torch and welcoming us to the United States as she had welcomed so many immigrants before us. As we walked down the slanting gangway, I thought of the kind captain and the friendly stewards. I felt pampered and petted, filled with delicious food and the strong knowledge that there are lots of good people in the world. What a glorious adventure. I was ready to start life in America.
And what does the young Melzinger learn on his first crossing? The life of a sailor is hard.
Tell Brill that he should stay in the fatherland and earn an honest living there. I can assure him that work on the outside is much harder, as he can see from my letter. Should I ever be lucky enough to sail as captain and shall have saved something, then I shall return to Hesse to await my last days there. There is no place more beautiful than where one's home is. If I should happily come home to Melsungen after my second trip, you will find me completely changed. The sea air is doing me no end of good.
The ship's boy actually becomes a captain. Edmund Badenhausen attends the Seaman School in Hamburg, gets his officer's commission, and becomes first officer, then captain of the mail steamer Frisia, From 1878, he captains the steamer Cimbria of Hapag, which is used on the passage from Hamburg to New York. After Bodenhausen rescues the crew of the schooner Julia and Mary from distress at sea, U.S. President Rutherford B. Hayes sends him a gold watch. Tsar Alexander II awards the Hessian captain with a medal for rescuing Russian sailors from a sinking ship. At the age of 41, Edmund Bodenhausen emigrates to the United States as the Hapag and the Lloyd have offered him another responsible position at their piers in New York. In February 1883, he becomes superintendent of the new pier of Hapag in Hoboken in New York Harbor. The captain from Hesse will never see his hometown, Melsungen, again. He settles in New Jersey with his wife, Katerina Marie, née Schomer, who was called Teeny Bee, his two daughters, and three sons. His granddaughter, Ida Hasse, told her cousin Bayard Bodenhausen about the crossing, as remembered by her mother Carola. This letter, written in 1959, can be read in the blog Bad Morgan by Susan Eldridge, Bayard's daughter.
Mother often told me about the stormy trip, how the stewards were sloshing about the dining room in their boots, how the deck chairs slid back and forth against the railing, etc. Uncle Henry was a tiny baby at the time, and Mother said he was bedded in a little box.
While Edmund Bodenhausen was Hapag's inspector of the harbor in Hoboken, Gustav Freiherr von Berg from Hungary also went ashore there with his daughter and a governess. His letters from 1893 were published the year after his return under the title To My Loved Ones in the Homeland. In the preface, he writes,
"At the age of 65, traveling is never pleasant, especially if you have an 18-year-old daughter who has a pronounced talent and special penchant for long journeys. If her wish had been the only decisive factor, we would now be sitting in Alaska, Japan, or the East Indies. Old memories are awakened in me. At the age of 18, I traveled for the first time on a railway from Harzburg to Braunschweig on the Feast of Pentecost. Today, every 4-year-old child has already traveled several thousand kilometers. Finally, you have to take the new zeitgeist into account. Mimi accompanies me, but alone? It's going to be harder. Miss Patterson from London, who had been in our house for a long time, offered to go along."
Of course, they do not travel in the tween deck of the Spree. On board is a famous American veil dancer, Miss Fuller from Fullersburg in Illinois, who performs for the benefit of the Sailors' Fund. After 9 days of sailing, the Spree is approaching New York, Hoboken, and Bedloe's Island, which will be later known as Ellis Island.
"The first piece of earth we saw was Sandy Hook Bar with a lighthouse. We sailed through the white and red Gedney Channel, then through the Narrows, and the most magnificent harbor picture in the world lay before our surprised eyes. In the middle, opposite us, New York, an elongated sea of houses surrounded by a wreath of harbor squares, piers that strongly remind the primeval forests of the hinterland. Everything is made of wood, still provisional, not like the ashlar-clad banks of the Danube in Budapest. Huge inscriptions denote the countless steamer routes, railway lines, and other things. On the right is Brooklyn, a suburb of 800,000 people. And the connecting link between the two is the Brooklyn Bridge, the largest suspension bridge in the world, almost 2,000 meters long, a miracle of human acumen. On the left of Bedloe's Island, we are greeted by the Statue of Liberty by August Bartholdi, the largest statue in the world. France donated it to the United States in 1886. And if we look back, a lovely picture of Long Island, New Jersey, with its wooded heights, small towns, villages. Magnificent and friendly villas lies behind us. In front of us, a large water mirror with ships of all countries. The largest passenger steamers, three masts, cargo steamers, yachts, brigs, ferries with whole railroad trains or omnibuses. Ferries for passengers and wagons, the size of a city apartment building for 1,000 people and 20 trucks with engines whose beamers reach above the deck and give them a peculiar expression. And then there is the ringing of the ships, their foghorns, a heathen noise. We stream past in amazement all the way to the Hudson, which separates New York from Hoboken with 43,000 inhabitants, where our steamer lands. We are in America. With the punctuality of an express train, our ship Spree lands at 8 o'clock in the morning at the pier of the Bremen Lloyd Hoboken on the left bank of the Hudson.
In Hoboken, Captain Badenhausen is very well respected, and he is known for his kindness. When he dies in New Jersey in 1902, at the age of 62, he is mourned by many people. His wife, Teeny B, travels several times to Germany, and in 1912 also visits relatives in Hesse. In 1922, she takes her 19-year-old granddaughter, Ida, to Europe. Ida has just graduated from high school.
The German mark was dropping in value constantly. When we left the United States, the exchange rate was 350 marks for a dollar. By the time the ship made it to Germany, it was 500 on the dollar. We had worn money belts with gold pieces because gold was the standard. However, they did not want the gold pieces, so we exchanged regular money for Deutschmarks.
In 1980, a year before her death, in a letter to her great-nephew Stephen, Ida wrote that she and her grandmother had put packages of notes into their wardrobe trunks, and when they had dinner in a restaurant, Ida put a package under the table and put her foot on it. In the long run, it was too difficult to exchange the coins, so they had the gold pieces melted down in the W.C. Harry S. Platinum Smelter in Hanau. Another of Edmund's descendants, a great-granddaughter, was in Melsungen in 1984. Her first name is Maritime History, Cambria.
Two brothers wanted to travel to America. They went with many others on the Cambria. The night was bright, then the fog rose. The ship pursued slowly the prescribed run. Suddenly, they saw a flash of green light. Help! Heavens! We're sinking! The Cambria, it breaks. Farewell, my brother. I can already feel the water. We have to drown, every one of us. We are all lost. And if you don't drown and be saved here, then return home and greet our people from me. But the brother doesn't answer. His mouth has already fallen silent, and the waters dragged the other one down, down to the ground.
The Moritat, from the Folk Song Archive, describes the last minutes in the lives of the brothers Wilhelm and Alexander Beuth from Espa in the Taunus, who drowned in the sinking of the Cambria. The wife of the pastor of Espa, Lydia Schmidtborn, writes the lyrics. Young people sing it for a long time to the tune of "If you want to love, you have to suffer." The accident occurs in 1883, not long after Captain Edmund Badenhausen has relinquished command of the Cambria. In the fog near the island of Barkum, the Cambria is rammed by the English coal steamer Sultan and sinks within a quarter of an hour. There are 91 crew members and 401 passengers on board. Most of them are emigrants from Eastern Europe or Germans like the Beuth brothers. The 20-year-old Edmund Adolf Olbers from Cuxhaven, or the 35-year-old milliner Helene Viga from Berlin, who has left her husband and travels with her children, Bertha and Alfred. Moritz Strauss, a Darmstadt toy dealer on a business trip, is also on the passenger list. The siblings Katinka, Augusta, and Georg Rahmer from Bierbach, who want to make their fortune overseas as Swabian songbirds, the native Red Jacket, his wife Sunshine, the medicine man Crowfoot, and three others who want to return to the United States from a European tour. Their fate inspired an unknown author and newspaper reader to write a poem in the same year that begins like this.
Shudder penetrates through all limbs when you read about the Kimbria. The steamship wanted to go back to America. When Cuxhaven is over, a heavy fog descended on the big wide sea. It was dark night all around.
And so the poem ends.
But it cannot be changed anymore. What has happened has happened. Deeply saddened in all countries, the people read in the paper now what disaster has happened. Hundreds of lives had to end at sea. Good Lord, the suffering is heavy. Caution is certainly needed on the ships as known. The swim belt and the lifeboats were all in good shape. But if fate willing that was to go down like this, this ship with man and mouse, our tears burst out.
Only 56 people were rescued. Almost all the women and children are among the dead. To this day, the sinking of the Kimbria is the greatest disaster of civil seafaring in German waters. In 1974, the wreck was found at a depth of 25 meters, 19 nautical miles northwest of the Isle of Barkum. From 2001 onwards, wreck divers took out of the wreck what wasn't attached. In the Cuxhaven Museum, Wind Force 10, the story of the Kimbria is told. In the Melsungen Archive and in the blog Bad Morgen, the story of Captain Badenhausen. And the Sterns from Nieder Omen? Hannah and Joseph Stern worked hard to build a new life for themselves. Ruth has written an autobiographical book for young people about her life as a migrant child, an accidental American. Her grandmother and uncles from Ulmbach have found refuge in Africa. Her aunt Rivka Stern, her mentally handicapped aunt Toni, her uncle Meyer, who was her father's brother, and his wife, her aunt Hedvig Stern, were murdered by the Nazis. Her cousins, Hilda and Carola, survived Auschwitz and came to the United States after the war. Hilda Cohen Stern's Holocaust poems were published after her death. Another Nieder Omener, Siegfried Frank, had sailed from Hamburg to Cuba in 1939 on the St. Louis, but the Cubans did not let the refugees ashore. They were also rejected in the United States and Canada. Captain Gustav Schroeder succeeded in distributing his approximately 900 passengers to other countries and thus saving the lives of many of them. Siegfried Frank found refuge in the Netherlands, but was deported soon after the invasion of the Wehrmacht and murdered in Auschwitz shortly before his 35th birthday. Captain Schroeder is commemorated today in Hamburg by a street, a park, and a plaque not far from the place where the St. Louis had departed in May 1939. And the band played. What special event does this wandering and soldier song from the 19th century still remind us of? On October 1, 1958, a troop transport from the United States docked at the cruise quay in Bremerhaven. On the quay, the girls were screaming, and a couple of guys were screaming too. At 9:22 a.m., Elvis Presley went ashore, in uniform, his duffel bag over his shoulder. At Bremerhaven Station, the train to Friedberg was waiting. 10 hours later, the 22-year-old was in his garrison, but days later he moved with his father, grandmother, and two bodyguards to a hotel in Bad Nauheim. As a jeep driver of a reconnaissance squad, he traveled a lot in Hesse during his military service, and whenever he appeared, children, adolescents, and adults gathered around him. Photos were taken and autographs were collected. At the end of his service in 1960, the King of Rock and Roll recorded Muss I Denn under the title Wooden Heart. In his film G.I. Blues, he languishes at Gretel, a hand puppet, in a Punch and Judy show, singing that song. An Upper Hessian version would sound like this.
Muss ich dann zum Dorf hinaus, zum Dorf hinaus, und du, mein Schatz, bleibst hier. Wenn ich komm, wenn ich komm, wenn ich wäre, wäre komm, bleib ich, mein Schatz, bei dir.
Must I then, leave this small town, and you, my dear, stay here. When I am back, when I finally return, I'll stay with you, my dear.
Only a few have returned, very few, forever.
You have been listening to the podcast, Now We Go Overseas, a free production from the Historical Society L'Astoria Bremen, with volunteers from the United States. This was part 3, Zwieback and Captain's Dinner, how a 5-year-old and a 17-year-old from Hesse experienced their first sea voyage and what became of them and others. Written by and final technical editing by Monica Felsing. English version directed by Susan Eldridge. Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and in Bremen, Germany, 2023-2024. The Historical Society L'Astoria wishes to thank every volunteer who participated in the Transatlantic Project about migration, as well as everyone who has performed the research and published information from which this was written. Our podcast consists of 6 parts. The original version is in German. The German historian Monika Felsing used AI for initial translations of her manuscript from German to English, which was then revised with help from Susan Eldridge, née Badenhausen. In this third podcast, we focused on 2 separate people who left Germany at a young age. We then learned what happened to other immigrants, as well as those who never completed their voyage. Ruth Stern Gaston, at 5 years old, fled with her Jewish family from Niederohmen in 1938. They arrived in America together through Ellis Island as refugees and lived in Chicago. Ruth later wrote a book called The Accidental American. The passages describing her experiences were read by Ruth herself. Edmund Badenhausen left Melsungen at the age of 17 in the middle of the 19th century and went to sea, worked his way through the ranks of the Hamburg American line to captain, and was then promoted to dock superintendent of the newly opening office of Hapag in Hoboken, New Jersey. Captain Edmund and his family entered America through Castle Gardens before Ellis Island opened. As a youth, Edmund wrote letters home, one of which was passed down through his descendants. This letter described his experiences during these first few days of getting hired and settled on his first voyage, which was translated by his granddaughter, Ida Asterida, née Haas. Some of the roles in this podcast were read by Captain Edmund's great-grandchildren, all of whom live in America. The introduction and a few poems were read by Susan Badenhausen Eldridge. The narrator sections were read by Kimria Badenhausen, who is named after the ship mentioned in this podcast. Edmund Badenhausen was read by John Badenhausen. The Ida, Haas, Asterita sections were read by Sintra Olson, née Badenhausen. The other roles in order of appearance are the song On Board Today is a Sailor's Song from the 19th century. The tune was written by an unknown composer, the German lyrics by Paul Wallrath in 1903 in Germany. This performance was recorded by the Chanty Chor Bremen Mondorf, a chanty choir in Germany. The lyrics from the song We Hover were written and read by Monika Felsing in Germany. The Physician was read by Lucien McRobbie in America. Heinrich Lemke was read by Reinhard Jung in Bremen. Gustav Freiherr von Berg was read by Burkhard Bach in Bremen, Germany. The Upper Hessian translation of the Swabian folk song Muss Eden was read by Helga Felsing in Germany. The English and German parts of the podcast are online in the United States at badmorgen.wordpress.com. That's badmorgen.wordpress.com. In Germany, you can find them at monikafelsing.de. That's monikafelsing.de. The manuscripts and bibliography will be available at a later date. If you would like to listen to them, please don't hesitate to contact us in Germany at mail@listoria-bremen.de or in the United States at badmoregenealogy@gmail.com. Our next podcast will be Part 4, A Home Far Away from Home, Emigration Becomes Immigration, Hessian Contributions to American History in the 17th and 18th Centuries. Copyright, all rights reserved. Public performance only with the permission from the Historical Society Listoria Bremen in Bremen, Germany, and Connecticut, USA, 2023 and 2024.